Hi there, this is the Romance Program. I'm volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. I've got one story coming up this hour from True Romance magazine called Growing Up in China. Here's the story. In the small Chinese village where I was raised, they have a saying, it's better to have a dog than a daughter. In that part of the country where almost everyone farms, sons are valued for their ability to work in the fields and to provide for parents in their old age. And because China has a policy allowing families to have only one child or two if they live on farms, many couples abort their female babies. Sometimes they even leave newborn girls out in the streets to starve. I was luckier than that. When I was born, my parents kept me, even though they already had Qing, my older sister. Other women would shake their heads and whisper behind their hands whenever my mother would walk through the marketplace with me and Qing. Two daughters meant two dowries to provide and no one to look after you in your old age. My mother would hold her head high and tell us not to listen to those words of criticism, veiled as pity. I have two beautiful daughters, she would say. Men will be happy to take them as wives, with no need of fancy dowries, and they will be good daughters and always care for their mother and father their whole lives. My mother's predictions proved true. With so few girl babies allowed to live, there was a shortage of brides for single men who were ready to start families. Despite my family's poverty, many men came to court Qing, and by the time I turned 15, I'd already had several offers for my hand. Qing was 2 years older than me, and when she was 17, she agreed to marry Zhu Li Hang, who was 26. He was a handsome, smiling man who already worked a farm of his own. He gave my parents many presents while he was courting Qing and promised to take care of them if they were his own mother and father, as if they were. Because we did not have much money, Qing's wedding was simple but very special. She and I both had new quilted jackets and skirts to wear. Hers was red, as is traditional. She also had new red silk shoes. Zhu hired musicians to follow him to our house on the day of the wedding. They played wedding songs, and Zhu's friends set off firecrackers and banged gongs. When he reached our house, Zhu handed out red paper packets of money to everyone. Then he drove Wing in a donkey cart to his parents' home, where they were married. Everyone was very happy. I thought Qing was very lucky to have found a good husband like Zhu. I went to visit them often, and he was always very nice to me. Even in a remote Chinese farming village, young girls are not so different than they are here in America. I often dreamed of getting away from the village and seeing the world. I wanted money to buy new clothes and fancy electronics and all sorts of wonders. Though I would never have said anything to upset my parents, I sometimes complained to Qing and Zhu about having to work such long hours in the field. I will be an old woman before I ever have any fun, I moaned. When I turned 16, Zhu and Qing surprised me with a pair of American-style blue jeans. Very fashionable. I was so happy with this gift and thought again how lucky Qing was to have found a husband like Zhu. Meanwhile, I felt the pressure to marry soon. Several men had already spoken to my father about marrying me. They offered very generous gifts to my family. Some fathers would have taken the best offer and ordered me to marry the man, but my father had a kinder heart than that. He told me I could choose my husband, but that I should choose soon. I knew the longer I remained single and at home, the greater burden I would become to my family. Our farm was small and poorly situated. No matter how hard we all worked each year, we were still very poor. The money my parents would receive at my wedding, not to mention one less mouth to feed, would mean a great deal to them. I was talking about all this one evening when I was visiting Qing and Zhu. "I'm not ready to get married yet," I said. "I would like to live a little first." "You mean travel, get a job?" Zhu looked at me. "That's right," I smiled, amazed that he knew me so well. "If I got a job, I could send money home to my parents. That would be better than what little they'd receive from a husband for me." Zhu lit a cigarette and glanced toward the stove where Qing was heating water for tea. Then he leaned toward me, his voice soft. "If I could get you a job in the city, would you like that?" I put my hand over my mouth to muffle a squeal. "Yes, can you do that? Get me a job?" He took another drag on the cigarette. "Maybe. I know some people who have a factory." He glanced at Qing again. "But don't say anything to anyone about this, not until I'm sure." I promised, though it was very difficult to keep quiet. A real job in the city, I would have money to buy things and to make my parents' lives easier. On the farm, we rarely saw as much as 1,000 won, about $110 each year. A factory job would surely bring much more than that. A few days later, my brother-in-law showed up at our door and asked to speak to me. I followed him out into the garden behind our house. "I spoke to my friends," he said. "They have a job for you." "They do?" I was so excited. I jumped up and down. "What is it? When do I start? How much will they pay me?" He shook his head. "I do not know the answers to these questions," he shrugged. "They say they have a job. Do you want it?" "Yes, of course I do." "Then pack your things and be ready to go with me at sunrise tomorrow. We have a long way to travel." Zhu left and I ran into the house to tell my parents my good news. My father frowned when I couldn't tell him who I would be working for, what my job would be, or how much I would be paid. "I don't know," I admitted, "but if I get there and I don't like it, I'm sure Zhu will take me back home." I squeezed my mother's hands. "Just think, I'll be able to send money every week. Things will be so much better for you." She nodded and stroked my cheek. "It will be hard not having you here," she said. "Promise me you'll be careful." "Of course." I kissed her cheek, then ran to gather my clothes together. I was too excited to even sleep that night and much too excited to worry much. It only mattered that I had a job and that I would be on my own, away from this little village and the drudgery of the farm. The next morning, Zhu arrived before sunrise. I ran out the door to meet him, my bundle of clothing in my hand. I was wearing my blue jeans in honor of this important day. "Let's go," he said. "I will say goodbye to my parents." I turned to go back into the house where my mother was preparing breakfast. "We don't have time for that." He grabbed me by the arm and shoved me down the lane toward the truck that was waiting for us. His gruff manner surprised me, but I didn't say anything about it. I was too afraid he'd change his mind and leave me behind. "Besides," I reasoned, "I would be back soon to visit my family, and I would send a letter the very next day explaining why I had to leave in such a hurry." We climbed aboard a truck on its way to the city with a load of chickens. We sat in the back amidst a stack of chicken crates. 4 other men were already there. They stared at me rudely as I took my place next to the cab of the truck. At first, I tried to talk to Zoo, asking him about his friends and the factory where I'd be working, but he refused to answer my questions. "You'll see when you get there," he said, then lit a cigarette and turned away. So I made myself as comfortable as possible in the crowded truck and soon fell asleep, my bundle of clothes in my lap. When I woke, Zoo and I were the only ones in the truck. The other four men were gone, and the truck's owner had stopped to unload the chickens. "Come with me." Zoo grabbed my arm and pulled me out of the truck, then hurried me along through the crowded streets. It was about 2 hours after sunrise, and the streets were crowded with people walking and on bicycles, threading their way through lines of cars and trucks that belched exhaust fumes into the air. People chattered in a dozen different dialects of Chinese, mingling in an indecipherable cacophony. We passed stores, their windows filled with colorful displays of bright clothing or books or produce. I wanted to stop and look at everything, but Zoo kept a tight hold of my arm and dragged me along after him. I stumbled on the uneven street and begged him to slow down, but he would not listen. "We must not be late," he said, and set off at a faster pace, forcing me to run to keep up. At last, we turned onto a side street. Zoo stopped and scanned the buildings, then pulled me up three steps and through a green painted door. At first, it was so dark inside, I could see nothing. I smelled sandalwood incense and cooking rice and the stale, musty air of a room that had not been cleaned in a long time. Gradually, I could make out a few objects, ornate carved chairs around a scarred table, a gold-framed mirror on one wall, a television set on a low table to my left. Still holding to my arm, Zoo dragged me to a door on the opposite wall and knocked. "It's Zoo," he said. "I have the girl I told you about." I stood up straight and got ready to meet my new employer. The door opened and a fat man in a green shirt stood before us. "So this is the one," he said, looking me up and down. I bowed very low. "I am honored to meet you," I said. The man nodded but said nothing to me. "You're sure she's a virgin?" I flushed, confused. What did my being a virgin have to do with anything? I looked at Zoo, who was insisting that, yes, I was a good girl, very dutiful. I had not dated any boys. I hugged my bundle of clothing tightly to my chest. Maybe the fat man wanted only good moral girls at his factory, good workers who would not get into trouble. The fat man seemed satisfied and pulled out a little cloth bag and gave it to Zoo. I heard the clink of coins and smiled. How nice of the man to pay a finder's fee to Zoo. I hadn't even started work at my job yet, and already good things were coming to my family. Without even looking at me, Zoo turned to go. I called after him. "Zoo, wait." He hesitated at the door. "What?" "I just wanted to say thank you for helping me." I smiled at him, but he had a very strange look on his face, as if he was about to be sick. He shook his head and hurried from the room. Behind me, the fat man started laughing. I stared at him. "What is your name?" I asked. His laughter stopped, and he looked stern. "My name is not important." He reached over and pulled a rope that rang a bell. Three men emerged from the back room. "You will go with these men," the fat man said. "Are they taking me to my new job?" I shrank back a little. The men didn't look very friendly. The fat man began laughing again. Yes, you could say that. They're taking you to your new job. One of the men grabbed my arm. I tried to pull away, but he jerked me toward him. You're very pretty, he said, but don't make me angry or I will hurt you. I stared at him, but said nothing. I glanced toward the fat man, but he was gone. For the first time since leaving home, I began to feel afraid. The three men led me outside and shoved me into a car. The car was dirty, but so were the men. I sat as far away from them as I could, but I couldn't escape their sour smell. One grinned at me, showing broken teeth, then said something to the first man who was driving the car in a dialect I didn't understand. All three men laughed, and the cold fear inside me grew. The first man drove fast, darting through the crowds, horn blaring. Soon we were out of the city. Where are you taking me? I asked, alarmed. You will see when we get there. We drove all day out into the countryside. I began to get very hungry, but when I asked the man for food, they laughed. One reached over and pinched my thigh hard. It will not hurt you to lose a little of that baby fat, he said, and they all laughed that horrible laugh. Mid-morning, they stopped the car and allowed me to relieve myself by the side of the road, but one of the men came with me. It was humiliating, crouching there with him looking down on me, laughing. By now, I was sure there was no job waiting for me, but something more sinister. I vowed to watch for my chance to run away from these men. If I could get back to the city, maybe I could find a job on my own, or at least make my way back home. That night, we stopped, and the men made camp by the side of the road. They tied me to the car with a leather belt around my wrist so that I could only sleep sitting up, leaning against the back tire. They gave me a bowl of rice and a cup of weak tea. After supper, they sat around the fire playing dice games and talking in that dialect I couldn't understand. From the way they kept looking at me, I thought maybe they were talking about me. One of the men, the tall one who wore a blue shirt, kept looking at me and grinning. He said something, and one of the other men laughed, but the driver frowned and shook his head. I looked away, not wanting to see these men. I thought about my home. About now, my mother would be washing the supper dishes while my father read the paper by lamplight. After supper, King and Zhu might stop by to play Mahjong. Would they stop by tonight? How could Zhu bear to look at my parents and Qing after what he'd done? Would he lie and tell them I was happy in my new job? Or did they all know the truth that he had betrayed me to these men in exchange for money? After a while, the fire died down and my captors went to sleep. But I couldn't sleep. I was cold and uncomfortable, unable to lie down and without even a thin blanket to cover me. I tried to loosen the belt that bound me tight, but the leather was thick and stiff and I couldn't move it. Sometime before dawn, I dozed, but too soon, Blue Shirt was shaking me awake and urging me into the car. That second day we crossed over the mountains. Snow lay in dirty patches beneath the trees, and I shivered when I climbed out of the car at midday to relieve myself. I breathed in the thin, sharp air and thought how far I was from my home. What was going to happen to me? Back in the car, I tried again to talk to my captors. Where are you taking me? I asked. You'll see, was the driver's cryptic answer. That night was a repeat of the night before. The men tied me to the car, gave me rice and tea, then began gambling. Blue Shirt leered at me and the driver scolded him. At last the men settled down to sleep. This time the men had belted me to the front of the car. Earlier I'd discovered a sharp edge along the underside of the car. As soon as I was sure the men were asleep, I began to rub the belt along this sharp edge. Several times I gouged my arm, but I didn't care. I had to get away from these men. Wherever they were taking me, I was sure it wasn't good. The moon rose and shone like a spotlight on the three men who slept around the fire. I rubbed back and forth on the belt, my arms aching and cramping, but I desperately kept on. Blue Shirt rolled over and I froze, praying he would go back to sleep. Instead, he sat up and looked at me. "What are you doing awake?" he whispered. I'm cold. This was true. Maybe he'd feel sorry for me and give me a blanket. A blanket might be useful as I made my way back to the city. He grinned, showing his broken teeth. "I will keep you warm," he said. He crawled toward me. I shrank back against the car as he drew near. I didn't want him to know what I'd been doing, and I certainly didn't want him touching me with his filthy hands. But he did touch me. He reached up and took my chin in his hands and tried to kiss me. I jerked my head away, trying not to gag at the stink of his breath or the hungry look in his eyes. Blue Shirt took hold of my arms and pulled me toward him. "I think it's time you started doing your job," he said as he reached under my jacket. I cried out and pulled away from him. The belt broke, freeing me from the car, but landing me in even bigger trouble. Blue Shirt's fingers tightened, digging into my arms. "What's this?" he demanded, not even bothering to try to be quiet now. I kicked out at him and clawed at him with my fingers, anything to be free of him, but he was much stronger than me and slammed my head into the fender of the car, then slapped my face so hard I thought my neck would break. "What's going on?" The driver awakened and rushed over to us, along with the other man. "She was trying to escape." Blue Shirt showed them the broken belt. "I stopped her." No mention that he'd been trying to molest me at the time. The driver glared at me, then said something to Blue Shirt, who scowled and dropped me. The driver shoved me into the car, then took a key from his pocket and locked the door. I tried to unlock it from the inside, but the latch had been fixed, so this was impossible. Blue Shirt laughed at me, and the others joined in. I settled back in the seat, refusing to look at them. It would be more difficult to escape from the car, but I'd still try. In the meantime, at least it was warmer and more comfortable. I lay down on the back seat and tried to sleep. Tomorrow I'd find another way to escape. But the next afternoon, the car turned off the main road onto a narrow dirt track. We climbed farther into the mountains, past terraced fields of rice and tea, through a little village where women and children and old men crouched alongside mud brick buildings and stared at the car as it passed. The men in the car became more animated. The driver handed me a canteen of water and told me to wash my face and comb my hair. "Where are we going?" I asked again, not really expecting an answer. Blue Shirt grinned. "You are going to start your new job." An hour later, the car slowed and stopped before a low mud brick building, more of a shack than a house. The structure leaned to one side, the tar paper flapping from its patched roof, the door sitting crookedly on its leather hinges. The driver got out of the car and came around to my side. "Welcome to your new home," he said. I stared at the shack. "I'm not staying here." He dragged me from the car. "There's a man here who paid a lot of money for you," he said, "so don't complain." The door of the shack opened and a scowling old man emerged. At least he seemed old to me, at least my father's age, if not more. The driver shoved me toward the man. "Here's your new bride," he said. "Congratulations." Then he burst out laughing again, his friends joining in. I could still hear that awful sound as they drove away. I stared at the man in the doorway. He scowled back at me. "I know what you're thinking," he said. He looked down the road in the direction the car had vanished. "Don't try to run away. There's no one here who will help you, and if you leave, it will disgrace your family who sold you to me." "My family didn't sell me," I said. "I was stolen. This is wrong." "It doesn't matter what you think. I paid for you, and now you belong to me." He grabbed my arm and pulled me inside. "Now go and prepare dinner for me." "I don't want to prepare dinner." I had barely finished speaking when the old man picked up a stick and hit me hard across the shoulders. I cried out and staggered back against the door, a red cloud of pain blocking my vision. "If you do not obey, I will beat you worse," he spat. The old man shoved me into the shack. "Now fix me something to eat." The shack was even worse inside than outside, filthy and smelling like a stable. Soot-stained lanterns provided the only light, which was just as well since the dimness hid some of the dirt. Still clutching my injured shoulder, I made my way to the rusting iron stove in the corner. I found some vegetables, rice, and tea and began to prepare a meal. After eating only two bowls of rice and some tea in 3 days, I was starving. When we sat down to eat our meal, the old man pulled out a bottle of wine and two glasses. "Drink up," he ordered me, "to celebrate your new life." I tasted the wine. It was sour. I made a face. The old man scowled at me. "Drink," he roared. I drank, afraid he would hit me again. After we ate, I cleared the table and washed the dishes. The old man turned down the lamp and motioned me toward the bed in the corner. "Come," he said. I stared at the bed, frozen. I knew this stranger, who was old enough to be my father, expected me to sleep with him, to be his wife. I shook my head. "No. I have a right to what I paid for," he said, dragging me toward him. I tried to fight him off, but he was much bigger than me and stronger. He hit me in the face and pulled my hair, then threw me onto the bed and began tearing off my clothes. I squeezed my eyes tight shut, tears running down my face, as he forced my legs apart and raped me. I sobbed out loud while he sweated over me, but he paid no attention. After what seemed like a long while, the old man heaved himself off of me. He turned up the lamp and held it high over me, looking down on me. "So you were a true virgin. At least I wasn't cheated." He threw a rag at me. "Clean yourself up." I glared at him, wanting to spit in his face, to scream at him, but I knew all that would get me was more beatings. Instead, I forced myself up and walked painfully to the water pail. As I cleaned myself, I cried more tears. I wanted to get away more than ever. The next months were a blur of daily beatings and nightly rapes. The old man never asked me my name, and he never called me anything but woman. I was expected to cook his meals, clean his house, and tend his vegetable garden and his pigs. If I so much as sat down to rest in his presence, he would pick up a stick and beat me. I cried until I thought I had no tears left, but the old man didn't seem to care. Every night I fought his advances, but that never even slowed him down. He talked often of the sons I would have for him. The thought of having a child that would tie me to this man sickened me. I made an extra effort to search the fields for special herbs and made a tea which I'd heard would prevent pregnancy. But I hid the tea from the old man, who would have been furious if he'd known. One afternoon, while I was weeding the garden, I looked up and saw a man ride up on a bicycle. My heart leaped as I recognized the uniform of a police officer. Maybe my mother and father had learned what Zoo had done to me and had notified the authorities. Maybe this man was coming to rescue me. I hurried into the house and found the old man and the police officer talking. My joy vanished when I saw them laughing and talking like old friends. The old man turned to me. "Woman, bring some tea for my old and respected friend, the chief of police." So now I knew that I could expect no help from local authorities. I would have to find another way to escape. I thought about sneaking out of the house one night after the old man was asleep and trying to find my way back to the city, but the terrain was rough and sparsely populated. Without a map or friends, I didn't see how I could make my way. People in the area knew the old man had purchased me and would only see to it that I was returned to him. I thought of writing a letter to my parents, but what if Zoo intercepted the letter? It wasn't unusual for him to collect the family mail from the post office, and it would be easy enough for him to keep out a letter in my handwriting. I wouldn't allow myself to think the worst, that my parents had known what Zoo was up to and agreed that I was a good thing, or it was a good thing. Finally, when I'd been with the old man 5 months, he announced that he intended to visit a neighboring town on business. I was to stay behind to care for the garden and pigs. "Don't you try anything while I'm away," he said. "The police chief and my other friends will be watching you." I nodded, trying to keep any expression from my face. Mostly, I didn't want him to see how glad I was that I wouldn't have to be around him for a couple of days. "May I go into the village to buy rice and thread from Wang Chong?" I asked in my meekest voice. "Yes, you may go there. Wang Chong is a good friend of mine." The next day, the old man set off on his business trip. An hour later, I walked to town. At Wang Chung's store, I bought rice and thread. I looked at sheets of fine writing paper and thought again of writing a letter home, but the postmaster was probably also a friend of the old man. All a letter would get me was another beating. I left the store and walked slowly through the streets of the village. It felt so good not to have to work so hard and to know that tonight I would sleep alone, unmolested. I passed a temple and decided to go in to light a red candle of thanks. Inside the temple, I was surprised to find another woman already there, or rather, I was surprised to see a woman who was not Chinese. She was an older woman with blonde hair, dressed in a brown suit and black tennis shoes. She was talking with one of the monks. They stopped talking when I entered. I bowed my head, conscious of the bruises from my latest beating, and started to slip out the door. "No, wait," the woman said in Chinese. "I was just leaving." She bowed to the monk and then to me, then left. I lit my candle before the altar and bowed low, then picked up my packages and hurried out the door. The woman was waiting there on the steps. "Hello," she said, again speaking Chinese. "My name is Wilma Collins, and I'm an American missionary working here." I walked faster, not wanting to speak to this woman. First of all, she was very rude to talk to me that way, but then I'd heard that some of these missionaries were very pushy about trying to convert the local people. But fast as I walked, Wilma Collins walked just as fast. "I couldn't help noticing your bruises," she said. A Chinese person would never say such a thing. To comment upon another's affliction shows terrible manners. I felt my face redden and ducked my head. "You are the girl I heard about," she said, "the one who lives with the Jiutsu." I slowed a little and looked at her. Her eyes looked kind. Still, I was afraid to answer her. "They say in town that he bought you for a wife," she said. I nodded with one swift jerk of my head. If they said it in town, there could be no harm in my acknowledging it. "Where are you from?" she asked. "I'm from a place in the United States called Minnesota. Very different from here. I am from Sichuan province," I said. Though I had vowed not to speak to her, I couldn't resist the temptation of talking to another woman, even if she was a stranger and a rude foreigner. "That's a long way from here," she said. "How did you end up so far from home?" She leaned closer to me, her voice gentle. "You look very young." I wanted to tell her why I was here, but my throat closed around the words. What if she didn't believe me? What if she told someone else and then told the old man? He might even be angry enough to kill me. If not that, he would surely make my life more of a hell than usual. I have to go," I stammered. "Wait," she touched my arm. I flinched, accustomed as I was to fending off blows. Wilma Collins drew back. "I only wanted to tell you if you need any help. I live in the little house behind the temple," she said. "The monks there can always tell you where to find me." I nodded, not sure if I believed her or not, and hurried back to the old man's house. I had expected to sleep well that night, but memories of my conversation with Wilma Collins kept me awake. Had she been serious when she said she would help me? The next morning I rose early. The old man was due home at noon. If I was going to do anything to help myself, I had to act quickly. Before the sun rose, I was on my way into town. I went straight to the temple, and when I was sure no one was watching me, I walked around to the back. Sure enough, there was a little wooden house there. I went up to the door and knocked, hoping Wilma Collins wouldn't be angry with me for waking her so early. But Wilma wasn't asleep. When she answered the door, she was dressed in the same brown suit she'd worn the day before. Her eyes widened when she saw me. "Please come in," she said as she bowed low. She made tea and served it with sweet rice cakes. "Please tell me how I can help you," she said. "It is true that you said yesterday... Or is it true that what you said yesterday," I said, "that Yusu bought me for his wife, but I did not come willingly. I was stolen from my family and brought here against my will." "Oh my," William looked sad. "I was afraid of something like that." She poured more tea, and as the sun rose, I told her my story, my desire for a job in the city, the trust I had placed in my brother-in-law, Zhu, and the horrible trip over the mountains with my three captors. Tears flowed as I talked. Wilma didn't say anything until I'd finished my story. She reached across the table and patted my hand. "I've heard other stories like yours before. There are other girls all over China who've been kidnapped and sold in this way. It's one of the reasons I'm here." I frowned. "I don't understand. Don't missionaries want to convert us to Christianity?" She laughed. "Part of being a Christian is helping those in need. The organization I'm with is working to help help women like yourselves who have been stolen from their homes and sold into virtual slavery." "What can you do to help me?" I asked. "First, we must get you away from here." She stood. "Are you prepared to leave right away?" I stared at her, hardly believing her words. "Yes," I said. "The sooner the better. The old man is due home at noon." Wilma glanced at her wristwatch. "Then we shouldn't waste any time. Wilma had an old car that belonged to her missionary society. She drove up to the door of the little house, and I hurried into the back seat. I crouched on the floor, and she threw a blanket over me. "I'm sorry it's not more comfortable, but it's only for an hour or so until we get out of the province." I almost laughed at her words. I had endured so much already. What was a little more discomfort? That night, Wilma and I stayed at a mission house on the other side of the mountain. "I'm going to take you tomorrow to a special house we've set up as a rescue center for women like you," Wilma told me as we ate supper. "The people there will be a big help to you." I bowed my head. "Thank you for helping me," I said, the same words I'd said to Zhu those long weeks ago. No wonder he looked at me so strangely. Wilma patted my hand. "I'm the one who should thank you for being brave enough to come to me," she said. "You helped yourself." The afternoon of the next day, Wilma brought me to a big whitewashed house in Sichuan Ban. A woman there took me to a clean, neat bedroom where I was offered a bath and new clothes to wear. A girl about my age came to escort me to dinner. "My name is Cao Yang," the girl introduced herself. "I have been here 3 weeks now." Were you kidnapped too?" I asked. She nodded, her face sad. "A man in the marketplace told me he knew of a good job for me. I followed him to an office where I was given drugs. When I woke up, I was far away from home with a man I did not know." Fresh tears stung my eyes. To know I wasn't the only one who'd been tricked was such a relief. Cao patted my hand. "You will get better here," she said. "I am much better already." After I ate, I met with a director of the rescue center. She explained that my family had been contacted and that if I wished, I could return to them. "I would like to see my mother and father again," I said. The director nodded. "That can be arranged. We will help you with counseling and even job placement and training if you desire." I almost laughed. Maybe I'd find that job I'd been looking for after all. Over the next few days, I had a medical examination which confirmed I wasn't pregnant, and I met with other women and girls like me who'd been sold as wives. I learned that an estimated 250,000 Chinese women each year are kidnapped and sold as brides. Many of them are never heard from again, though others like me are rescued by activists like Wilma Collins and others. Though Chinese law prohibits the sale of women, the problem persists because women are in such short supply and men are willing to pay high prices for wives. I learned that Zhu had received 8,000 won for me, almost $1,000, or 10 times my parents' annual income. After 4 weeks at the center, I received a letter from my parents. Joy filled me as I opened the envelope and read their greetings. "Dearest daughter, we rejoice to know you are alive and well." The letter went on to say that my parents and sister had no idea that Zhu had betrayed me. They thought that once I moved to the city, I had no time for them anymore, or that I had purposely run away from home. "The police have arrested Zhu and he will have to stay in jail a long time." This was good news for me, but bad news for Qing and my parents. With Zhu in jail, their income would be severely reduced. All the more reason for me to hurry home. But my happiness vanished when I read the last paragraph of the letter. "We think it would be best if you did not return home at this time," my father wrote. "There is much gossip and many people know what happened. People know you have left behind a husband, and not everyone thinks this is a good thing. You will have a much better chance of finding happiness in the city." Even as I rebelled at the unfairness of these words, I knew they were true. No young man would come to court a woman who had already had one husband, whatever the circumstances. If I came home, I would be a burden to my family, not a help. I cried for a while over that letter, then tucked it away and went to see the director. My family thinks it best if I don't come back to our village, I said. The director nodded. Yes, it is often that way. Sometimes it's better to start a new life somewhere else. Can you help me? I asked. That's why I'm here. She motioned for me to sit down. Do you know where you'd like to go? I shook my head. I don't know. Anywhere I can find a job and, as you say, start over. She smiled. What about America? America? My eyes widened. Could I really go there? Wilma Collins was quite taken with you. She's recommended you for sponsorship by a family in the United States. You would live with this family and go to school and learn English. Then they'd help you find a job and get established in the community. I sat back in the chair, stunned. The United States was so far away, so different from China, but maybe different was exactly what I needed. I nodded. Yes, yes, I would like to go to America. On a cold winter day, I arrived in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I was met by the Chang family. Mr. and Mrs. Chang owned a chain of restaurants in Minneapolis. They had three children, Lucy, who was 15, May 12, and a son, Henry, 10. The Changs had lived in Minneapolis for many years, and all the children had been born there. Welcome to the United States, Mrs. Chang said. We hope you'll be happy here. The next year, I had times of great happiness and times of sadness, too. I missed my family and my home in China, but the Changs did their best to make me welcome and to introduce me to all the wonders of my new home. May, Lucy, and Henry helped me with my English. They showed me how to dress like an American teenager and introduced me to American music, television, and fast food. After 6 months, I was doing well enough to enroll in high school with Lucy. Though I was a little older than most of the students, no one seemed to notice. I discovered that I liked school very much, and when I graduated from high school, I promptly enrolled in college. If you saw me today, you'd probably think I was a typical college student. You'd never know I was once a virtual slave to a man who had paid $1,000 for me. Even inside, I'd feel very far away from that poor girl who suffered so much. But I haven't forgotten about that girl. In school, I'm studying to be a teacher. I hope to return to China someday as a missionary like Wilma Collins, to help other young women like me. Okay, that's the end of that story. That was pretty depressing, but at least it all worked out for the best. So if you tuned in late, this is the Romance Program with Volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. And I have some time left, so I'm going to read two or three poems to end this show. This first one is from True Romance magazine. It was written by Marcia Weaver Desboro. It's called At Last I Fly. Promising to save me from my loneliness, bringing me out of my shell, you turned my home into a prison and brought me down to hell. I knew it wasn't my fault, surely. I had done nothing wrong. So I closed my ears to your words when the nights were oh so long. When you knew you could never break me, you hated me and I wished I would die. So I quickly planned my escape. Yet someday I would fly. Yes, someday I would fly. I vowed not to let you take my soul, and that filled you with such rage. My strength somehow frightened you, for you knew I'd never stay caged. I dreamed of making new friends and having pretty dresses to wear. Perhaps I would go dancing or get a perm in my hair. When you beat, kicked, and belittled me, it was you who felt frightened and small, now I can spread my wings and fly because I survived you after all. Okay, well, that poem actually kind of went with that story I just read, so I'm glad I found that one. So now I have another poem from True Romance magazine. This one was written by Rachel Squires Bloom. It's called Personal. Seeking someone in autumn, spring's expectations, blooming and fertility, and all that hype always let me down. I desire gray weather, the choice of staying indoors, no obligation to skate or sail or covert, simply because no clouds blanket our beckoning stars. Looks not important as long as you're looking at me, our eyes a continuum of energy and lust. What I offer, indecipherable stares, body of a schoolgirl, well, maybe a grad student, am not as neurotic as you are. No yuppies, but with the security of one. I'm sure I want these things because I've had them. Actually, I don't want them without you. Cancel this ad. Okay, so one more poem to finish this romance program. This is also from True Romance magazine, and it was written by Michael F. York, called Lady Liberty. Here's the poem. I wonder what she thought as she stood strong and tall. She could not turn away, forced to watch it all. Did she long to offer comfort as her country bled, her arm forever frozen high above her head? Could not shield her eyes, could not hide her face, just stared across the water, keeping freedom's place. The smell of smoke and terror somehow reduced her size, so small within the water, but still recognized. How dignified and beautiful on a day so many died. I wonder what she thought. I know she must have cried. Okay, so that's going to do it for this edition of the Romance Program. As always, thank you so much for listening to my stories and my poems. I've enjoyed reading you. This has been Volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. Have a great week. Take care of yourselves, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.